This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Shiur on the subject of nonverbal communication after you've heard a lecture by an expert on the subject, because one starts becoming all conscious, and instead of listening to the shiur, you're likely to watch my nonverbal communication. So I didn't know whether not to bother preparing the shiur and just act it out, or whether to prepare the shiur and just stand in a straitjacket. But we'll see as we go on. The first principle that I want to put forward is the understanding that there is really a very narrow line that differentiates between verbal and nonverbal communication. Verbal communication means the content of the words that we use, the content of the message. Nonverbal communication is that message or that part of the message which we communicate through expressions other than the use of language. But even in a strictly verbal communication, even if I were to speak to you with taking the utmost care not to use my hands and not to move and not to wink an eye, nevertheless, the muscles of my mouth are still working. It is impossible for a human being to communicate verbally without the utilization of nonverbal communication at the same time. It's possible for him to write verbally without the use of nonverbal communication. But the moment a person starts speaking, his mouth is moving. And once his mouth is moving, he's already into the area of nonverbal communication. That point is made by the Bala Tanya. Where he differentiates between the term dibur, speech, when used in association with a human being, and on the other hand, when the same term is used in association with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he says in Perek Kaf Aleph, "Hinei midas HaKadosh Baruch Hu sheloi kemidas boso v'dom." The midah of the Ribbono Shel Olam is not the same as that of a human being. Sheha'odom, for a man, kishemedaber dibur, when he speaks, when he utters a speech, harei hevel hadibur shebepiv. We had the word this afternoon in the Vilna Gaon. The hevel, the air, the words of the dibur of his mouth, who murgash v'nir'e dovar bifnei atzmoi, is perceived and seen as something that stands on its own, something independent of the speaker. Muvdal mishorshoi, separated from its root. Aval HaKadosh Baruch Hu ein diburoi muvdal mimeno yisboruch chas v'sholim. But the dibur of the Ribbono Shel Olam, the speech of the Ribbono Shel Olam, is not separated from the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, chas v'sholem. Ki ein dovar chutz mimenu, for there is nothing apart from him. So whereas we can see the human being and his words as two different entities, and in fact we can see him speaking, we can lip read, we can hear the words, and it's separate, it stands on its own. When we talk about the Ribbono Shel Olam, the words and the essence of the Ribbono Shel Olam are inseparable. So why then, he asks, is the term dibur used in association with Ribbono Shel Olam? It's not an accurate association. The lo nikra diburo yisborach b'shem dibur rak al derech moshe, and Hashem's speech is only called that by way of image. Kemo shehadibur hatachtoin shebeodom, just as our speech down here, human speech, hu megale lashoimim ma shehoyo tzofun v'ne'elam b'machshavtoi. The purpose of speech is to reveal to the listener that which was buried deep in his consciousness and sometimes subconsciousness. Kach lemaile bein sof baruch hu, so in the upper worlds, in the Ribbono shel Olam, yetzias ha'or v'hachayus mimenu yisborach me'ahelem el ha'gilui, the expression of his light and life from potential, from being hidden away, el ha'gilui, to being revealed, livroi olomus, whether it's through the creation of worlds, it was an idea in the Ribbono shel Olam's mind, so to say, and then the idea came into expression, ulachayosom, and to give life to the worlds, nikro b'shem dibur, that's called dibur. It's not that the Ribbono shel Olam utters words and those words stand on their own. The dibur is a term used in the Torah for a revelation of the Ribbono shel Olam's deepest intent. That's what dibur is. Whereas in the human being, dibur can be separated from the speaker. It stands on its own, separate. And so we see the difference between a human dibur, human speech, and the speech of God, is that the speech of the Ribbono shel Olam will always and can only be the expression of that which is deep inside him. Whereas the speech of a human being was designed for that purpose, but is not necessarily used only for that purpose. We see it's designed for that purpose by something that the Baal HaTanya says further on in the Igeres HaKodesh in Perek Hei, where he discusses the observation that when you teach a child to speak, you don't say to him, well, you know, to say peh, you've got to put your two lips together like that and then breathe and open them suddenly and out will come a peh. It doesn't work like that. When the child wants to say peh, his mouth automatically takes that formation. When he's able to understand, it automatically takes that formation. There is no direct instruction to the mouth to form itself in a particular way in order to pronounce a particular word. That is something, it's an involuntary sort of reaction to a deep desire buried right inside the mind to express itself in a particular way. And so automatically, says the Baal HaTanya, when a person wants to say a comet, the sound of a comet, and all his mouth goes like that. He doesn't even know it's happening. And when he wants to say a patach, his mouth smiles openly. He doesn't know it's happening. It's not an instruction. Now I must open my mouth this way, and now I must open my mouth that way. That's not how we speak. The mouth responds and expresses unconsciously the deepest desire of the human being. And just as it is that way linguistically, the Baal HaTanya is using an image. Just as linguistically we are not giving a specific instruction to the mouth, but the mouth is doing that which we really want to say deep down. We want to say ah, that's what we want. So the mouth knows how to form itself in such a way to say the ah, but we don't tell the mouth what to do. It knows how to do it automatically. It's programmed. So in a deeper sense, the mouth is programmed, the power of speech is programmed to reveal the inner thoughts and feelings of the human being. And there again we see that the mouth was designed to play the same part, kibiyochel, as the Ribbono shel Olam's own expression of his will by means of what the Torah calls dibur, speech, but isn't really speech. For the Ribbono shel Olam has no mouth, and therefore he doesn't speak. So why does the Torah use the word dibur? Because dibur, says the Baal HaTanya, means, not speech, it means a revelation of deepest conscious and subconscious thoughts. And the way human beings do it is through speech. That's what the power of speech was given to us for. Ribbono shel Olam has other ways of doing it, and we call that speech as well, because that's the only term we can use that accurately describes what's happening. But that's speech. Nevertheless, the fact is that in the Ribbono shel Olam's case, it's so to say impossible for his speech, in inverted commas, to reflect and express anything at all other than that which is in his deepest consciousness. Whereas the human being, since his speech is separate from himself, as the Baal HaTanya says, since the human being's speech is you can see it as something separate, you see the lips moving, you hear the words, you can write it down and there it stands. Therefore, it is possible for the human being to use his speech to do something other than express his deepest will. That's the important yesod. Whatever the Ribbono Shel says is accurately what he wants and what he feels and what he, and there's absolutely not the minutest deviance between what he says, so to say, and what he thinks. But the human being, you're never quite sure. It's possible for the human being to allow his speech to go off on a wild tangent and to say things which do not match 100% with that which he feels in his deepest being. And that explains to us the whole concept of a fellow called Esav. The Torah tells us, Vayehav Yitzchok es Esav. And Yitzchok loved Esav. Any cheder child can tell you that Esav was a Rosha. Yitzchok, one of the Ovris, the son of Avraham Avinu, he fell for it. And he loved Esav. Why? Because there was hunting in his mouth. Rashi brings two views from the Medrash. One means there was hunting in the mouth of Yitzchok. Esav used to bring Yitzchok delicious things. Whenever he found a really special food, he used to bring it to Yitzchok. He used to keep it for Yitzchok. And Yitzchok used to appreciate that. That's difficult to say that because of that, Yitzchok loved Esav. Was that a reason to love a person? In any event, that side of the Medrash is not to our concern, but the second one is, Befiv shel Esav. Yitzchok liked Esav because there was hunting in his, Esav's mouth. Shehu yotzad oisoi umerameihu bidvorov. For he used his mouth to hunt Yitzchok, and he cheated him with his words. It is possible to portray an image. We're still talking verbally. We're not talking non-verbally yet. We're still talking verbally. But since the human speech, unlike the speech of the Ribbono Shel Olam, stands on its own as an entity on its own, it can be utilized and designed and programmed to say its own thing. And although it was given to us for the purpose of expressing our deepest thoughts, it is possible to create out of speech the expression of something which isn't our deepest thought. And Esav was the master. Esav knew how to do just that. How to create the mood and the atmosphere with his power of speech, which fooled even Yitzchok into believing that Esav was righteous. That is something that the power of speech can achieve. But of course it wasn't only verbal communication. A person who acts like a Rosha and comes and talks like a Tzaddik is not going to fool anybody. And that was part of the whole discussion on Tuesday evening, that there has to be an integration between the verbal and the non-verbal communication. That when one starts trying to express one message verbally and a different one non-verbally, the result is total lack of credibility. It's quite clear that one's being dishonest. Yitzchok was clearly perceptive enough to have seen through that. So Esav was not only a master of verbal communication. Esav knew how to play the part in every aspect. He knew how to portray himself convincingly as a tzaddik. How to act the part, talk the part, absolutely convincingly. That was Esav. So we see the utilization both of the power of speech and of nonverbal communication for evil. That was Esav. So we have other cases that the Medrash says Esav was Merameis Habriyas. He used to cheat humanity, not only Yitzchok. He used to seduce women. One can't seduce women only with verbal communication. You can't go up to an Eshes Ish and give her a logical argument why she should have an affair. That doesn't work. A seductor is also a master of nonverbal communication. A person who knows how to portray feelings and messages of love and concern and affection nonverbally, quite apart from verbally. Esav was a master at the art of communication, both verbal and nonverbal. And we see already that Chazal recognized the importance of nonverbal communication. Because Shlomo HaMelech says, the Rambam brings it in Hilchos Deis, Gam b'derech shaksil hoylech, even the way a fool walks, Oyumel lakol, kasil shaksilhu, shesakilhu. He tells, he announces to everybody, I am a fool. You can tell by the way a person walks that he's unintelligent. Shlomo HaMelech says, you don't have to open your mouth even. Non-verbal communication is enormously effective and was recognized as such since the beginning of man. And that explains that Midrash Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Gemara in Megillah, Osur le'odom lehistakil bidmus odom rosha. It is forbidden for a man to look at the image of a wicked man. Shene'emar in abit elecho ve'im ereko. It was Elisha who refused to look at the king of Yisrael, who at that time was a rosha. And he said, I swear that if it were not for Yehoshaphat's presence, I wouldn't be talking to you, I wouldn't even look at you. And Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai learns from there that it's also listakil bidmus rosha, bidmus odom rosha. It's forbidden to look at the image of a wicked man. Not allowed to look at him. Why not? So most people learn the pshat is because looking at evil affects one. One is affected by the evil. Looking at ugly things affects one, just as looking at beautiful things affects one. And looking at evil affects one negatively, just as looking at the tzaddik affects one positively. But the Gemara goes on to say, Rabbi Elozer says, if one does look at it at a rosho, one's eyes become dim. That's really more difficult to understand. That it affects one's vision, that it affects one's ability to see. And his proof is Shneemar Vayehi ki zokein Yitzchok Vatichoheno Einov. When Yitzchok became old, his eyes became weak. Says Rabbi Elozer, Mishum de Istakil Bebe Esav. That was because he used to look at Esav. He lost his eyesight when he was older because he used to look at Esav. What does that mean? And we've just come to the conclusion that Esav must have looked like a tzaddik. If he looked like a rosho, then Yitzchok would never have fallen for it. Yitzchok was clever. Yitzchok had ruach hakodesh. Yitzchok had perception. He would never have looked at an evil, mean, wicked face and have thought, my goodness, a tzaddik, a fine person. He was beyond that. Even we would have been able to perceive the wickedness if he looked wicked. So we see clearly that Esav looked like a tzaddik. He had a long black coat, he had a beard down to his knees, he had a big shtroimel or a big black hat that he used to walk with. He used to take the longest in the davening, he used to shockle the hardest, his tzitzis used to stick out the furthest. He used to ask the most complex of shailas, the frumest of shailas he used to ask. There was nothing in his behavior except one or two things which Esav did pick up and was worried about. In his midas, in his derech eretz, a little bit. He didn't used to say please and thank you. That was all that Yitzchok could pick up. You remember when Yaakov came and said, please, Father, eat. Yitzchok felt that wasn't Esav talking. Please, he doesn't remember hearing that word from Esav. Here and there, Esav slipped up. But the general impression must have been one of enormous tzidkus of righteousness. So what is the harm of looking at Esav? How is it possible that looking at Esav caused Yitzchok to go blind? Therefore, I want to learn pshat that the issue to look at an Odom Rosha is not because he looks wicked. If he looked wicked, you would be allowed to look at him. The problem is because he looks righteous. And you start getting taken in. And you start beginning to believe that the wicked man is in fact not too bad after all. He smiles nicely. He's kind to you. He flatters you. He compliments you. He looks normal. He's got a frum face. He wears frum clothing. Can he be so bad after all? And the more one looks at him, the more one comes to terms with his wickedness and begins to accept it as normal Jewish behavior. That's the issur. Also listakel ba'odam rasha. Not because he looks wicked, because he looks righteous. That's the problem. He's fooling you. He's using nonverbal communication to manipulate you. He's using body language to manipulate you. It's all an act and you're going to get taken in. That's why you're not allowed to look at a rasha. Every rasha knows how to use body language. Every rasha knows how to use an act. Every rasha knows how to be convincing. If he didn't know, society would have kicked him out ages ago. His art lies in convincing society that he is in fact righteous. His art lies in convincing society that he's authentic and real and sincere. And he's a master at it. That's why you're not allowed to look at him. Because he's cleverer than you. And he'll convince you too. And that's why batichoheno eino, your vision suffers afterwards. You can't see properly afterwards. You can't distinguish between tzaddik and rasha afterwards. It starts becoming blurred. Doesn't mean that you physically go blind, not only that, but that your perception suffers. Because once you've been taken in with an act, you no longer know where you stand. And then you become disillusioned. You don't know who to believe and who not to believe, who's acting, who's real. One becomes totally confused. That's the danger of looking at an Odom Rosho. What did Esav think, as a matter of interest? What was his original thought? Why did he love Esav? Surely Yitzchak could have seen that Esav was putting on an act. Yitzchak, maybe we would have fallen for it. But Yitzchak? A very long time ago, I gave a shiur on this whole parasha. And I suggested that, of course, Yitzchak knew that Esav was an actor. A manipulator, a scheming politician. But Yitzchok realized that the Jewish people needed somebody like that. And the beauty of these twins, Yitzchok believed, was that they were two different people in one. But Yaakov could sit at Ish Tam Yoshev Oyholim, says Rashi, what is Tam? Einoi Baki Becholele. He's not familiar with all these acts and all this conniving and seduction. Keliboy kein piv. Like his heart, so is his mouth. Yaakov says what he feels, and he feels what he says, and that's it. Misha einoi chorif l'ramay, somebody who's not sharp to scheme, to mislead. Koroi tam, he's called a simple person. Perfect, simple, straight. And Yitzchak thought this was the ideal partnership. The Jewish people are going to need powers of persuasion. They're going to need the skills of diplomacy and politics. They're going to need salesmanship. You know, you can't persuade somebody to commit themselves on the basis of facts. You can give a philosophy lecture with facts because you're not asking for a commitment. If we're sitting down to a debate as to whether a Rolls Royce or a Volkswagen is a better motor car, we can discuss facts. And I can persuade you at the end of it maybe that the Rolls Royce is a better motor car. But that's not going to get you to put your money in your pocket and buy a Rolls Royce. For that one needs emotion. For that one needs seduction. For that one needs persuasion. For that one needs to wipe the person off his feet and excite him and enthuse him. Facts don't excite. Facts don't enthuse. Facts don't stimulate the emotions at all. And if one's emotions aren't stimulated, one's not going to become committed. And Yitzchak realized that the Jewish people are going to have to spread monotheism, they're going to have to spread Yiddishkeit, they're going to have to spread a belief in the Ribbono Shel Olam, and a commitment to that. They're going to have to get people to give up their immorality, to sacrifice their immorality, and to become ethical and straight. That's going to require commitment. It's going to need the most effective sales job that has ever been done. And Yitzchak realized that Yaakov could never do it. But if Yaakov was called upon to give a drosha to millions of non-believers, what would he do? He would start learning a sugi of Gemara with him, the Rashi Tosfos. There would be no connection.
Ishtam Yeshevayan. Yaakov was the Rosh Yeshiva. Yaakov was the London. He sat and he learnt and he analyzed and he studied with never a word out of his mouth that could have the slightest suggestion of anything not absolutely true. No exaggeration, no drama, no nothing, just Emes. But that isn't going to persuade the world. The man who's capable of moving the world and persuading it is Esau. Provided Esau will accept leadership from Yaakov. Provided Esau will consult Yaakov. And Yaakov can remain clean and untainted from the practical world of manipulation. He can sit in the Beis HaMedrash and just learn and remain absolutely pure. And Esav goes out and does the, so to say, dirty work, and comes back and gets cleansed by Yaakov, who once again stimulates him and puts him right and straight and sends him off again. And therefore, Vayehav Yitzchok es Esav ki tzayid b'fiv. Yitzchok loved Esav's ability to hunt, to persuade, to convince, to deal, to negotiate. That was something that they didn't have in the family before. This is a new element which Esav possesses. And he wants Esav included, because he feels that by Esav doing this job, it leaves Yaakov clean. And he's got the both jobs being done in separate people, so that Esav can become a specialist in his area, and Yaakov remains the specialist in his area. Later on, at the time of the brochas, you know, Yaakov goes so against his grain, even though his mother's a Nevi'ah and tells him that he's got to go and he's got to get the dressed up and to play the part and act. For the first time, Yaakov is called upon to act. And the Medrash says he went about it kofuf, with tears, subjected, heartbroken, as he went about doing his mother's will. He didn't know how to, he couldn't bring himself to put on an act. True, it's with Nevuah he was instructed to by a prophetess. True, it was his right. He bought that right, he purchased that right. True, it was in the interests of Klal Yisrael and the history of humanity that he should get those brochas. But at the end of it, it still meant an act. It still meant acting out the whole thing with verbal and non-verbal communication. Convincing Yitzchok that he was really Esau. It went so against his grain, but he did it. And Yitzchok is confused. Yitzchok isn't quite sure what's happening. There's been a change. He speaks like Yaakov. He smells and feels like Esau. What's happening? And in his confusion he says, Deshono v'amushcho b'ni. Come close that I can feel you. Are you Esav or aren't you? Vayigash Yaakov el Yitzchok oviv, and Yitzchok drew near to Yaakov his father, and Yaakov drew near to Yitzchok his father. Vayemusheyu, and he feels him. You can imagine Yaakov's heart pounding at that moment. Strokes him and feels him. Vayemer, and he doesn't say, yeah, yeah, you feel like Esav, so you must be Esav. He says, I call Yaakov, v'hayodayim yedei Esav. The hands are the hands of Yaakov, the voice is the voice of Yaakov, and the hands are the hands of Esav. So what does that mean? That he's got a third son who he never knew about? What does it mean? That Yaakov and Esav have suddenly become Siamese twins? What does he think in his mind? And he goes ahead and gives him the bracha. He knows it's not Esav. He knows it's not Yaakov. So who does he think it is? The answer is, it's no longer important to him. This is one man who contains within him the inner voice of Yaakov, uncompromised, unblemished, untainted, true. And yet he's developed the manipulative ability of Esau. He's managed to act. He pulled it off. This boy of mine who I thought couldn't act. And for that reason I believed it had to be Esau. And that's why the Ribbono Shel Olam made them twins, so that they could stay separate. I wanted them separate. Now I see that all this time Rivka has been right. Yaakov's the one. Yaakov has been able to incorporate the Midah of Esau without it tainting his inner being. And therefore, this is the man. Or whoever it is, maybe it's Esav who's got Yaakov's, but whoever this is standing before me is a man who has been able to integrate the midas of Esav and Yaakov without detracting from the effectiveness of the hands, the manipulation, and without detracting from the purity of the koil, of the inner voice. Both have remained intact. And this new being, whoever he is the person who gets the bracha. And so Yitzchak gives him the brachas. So we see early on in the Torah already the need for acting, the need for drama. In this case, it was to fool Yitzchak, in a sense. And we use that need. The Rambam says, for example, that kas, anger, is one midah which we're not permitted to possess at all. We are never allowed to get angry. Under no circumstances, whatever. Asks the Rambam, sometimes somebody is naughty, misbehaving, and if you don't get angry, they'll carry on. Any mother knows it, and some fathers know it, that there comes a time where the only thing that will stop the child is when the mother loses her temper. Then for a few minutes, the child will keep quiet. Says the Rambam, okay, then act angry. You have the ability, since Yaakov, you know how to act. We know how to project an image of something which is not really inside us. So while inside you have to remain placid and calm, you've got to project the image of anger, of fury. And that will do the job. There's no need for you to get all knotted up inside you. All that's important is that they think you're angry. So fool them. Act. There again we see that there is a place for drama. There is a place for acting. One needs to know how to act. Because there are times when it is necessary to create an impression different to the one which you're feeling at that particular time. That's the art of acting. That's the first part of the shiur, where we've established that whereas in the Ribbono Shel Olam's case, his expression is always identical to his inner thoughts and feelings. In the human being, that is not necessarily so. The human being has the ability to create an image out of his words and deeds totally different to his inner thoughts. And so Esav HaRosho is able to portray an image of Tzidkus which convinces even his father, and certainly the rest of humanity. And yet we find that that very ability is something which the Ribbono Shel Olam wants incorporated within Torah, and so Yaakov learns the skills too, and is able to carry it off. And we find in the halacha of the Rambam an example of where one has to act, because one has to create an image, or project an image differently, different to the one that one feels at that particular moment. But is that the only role for acting? Is the purpose of acting in a drama to be used only when I'm trying to say something which I don't really feel? But when I'm talking about things which I do really feel and which are true, then maybe there's no need for acting. One hits that question, for example, in the whole issue of different styles of giving shiurim, even lecturing. There are some shiurim which are very factual. The Magid Shiur gets up and he reads and he translates and he explains and he closes his gemara and he goes out and he comes in the next day and he does the same thing. It's beautifully structured. Question, answer, explanation, proof, end of shiur, QED, out you go. And there are other shiurim where the Magid Shiur gets excited and he gets all involved and it's dramatic and there's build up and there's tempo, and it's a mastery of dramatic technique. There's climax and there's anticlimax. There's everything that you need to retain attention and to create an air of excitement. Is that wrong? Is one using drama to portray elements which aren't really there, which aren't really needed? Shouldn't the shiur just be factual? These are the facts. This is the text, this is its translation, this is what it means, this is the question I have, these are the answers. Finished. That's all we need. That's the Torah. What do we need the extraneous drama for? Do we need the extraneous drama? Which is the correct, the more correct approach? We have two terms which are used in many different contexts. Chomer and Tzura. Chomer means the raw material. Tzura means the form, the finished product, the presentation. So one can say that this building, the chomer of this building, is bricks, it's sand and cement and wood. That's the chomer. The tzura is a house. One can go further. The tzura, or one can say the chomer was a house. That was the raw material. The tzura is a Beis HaMedrash. There are different levels of chomer and tzura. When a lady prepares a meal, theoretically, what she should do is figure out the needs of her, those who are going to partake of the meal. How much protein they need, how much carbohydrates they need, how much fat they need, how many vitamins of the different types they need, and she should structure her meal in such a way as to give them what they need. And you should arrive there and you'll find a big dish with a mush inside, and she'll tell you, I know it doesn't look too good, but everything you need is inside it. The right amount of proteins, the right amount of everything you need is there. We know what would happen. There would be a lot of full plates that would need to be taken afterwards, taken away afterwards, and a lot of guests would go home for supper afterwards. Why? Maybe it's even tasty. Maybe she even puts in spices and salt and makes it quite tasty. Still, only the extremely polite would go ahead to eat it. Why not? It lacks presentation. That's all. It doesn't look appetizing. How important is that? We know from ourselves, when it comes to food, fairly important. We like the food to look good. We like the table to look good. We like the food to smell good, to be laid out nicely, to taste good. It's not good enough that it's nutritious. That doesn't stimulate a desire for the food. And again, we're talking about commitment. The balabosta can sit me down and explain to me why that dish of mush that she's put in front of me is the most healthy thing I could possibly eat. That nowhere else would I get such nourishing food. And I would have to agree with her on the basis of the facts. And then when she sits down and she says, no, I have to excuse myself and say, I'm very sorry, you're quite right. But she said, but you agreed with me that there's nothing more healthy. But not when you're asking me to make a commitment. You're asking me to debate a philosophy, I'll agree with you. But now you want me to put that mush into my mouth? That's not prepared to do. Why? What's wrong? It's not appetizing, it's not nice, it doesn't make me want to. That's all. When one eats, unless one is desperately hungry, one needs to be made to want to eat. And so it is with everything we want we do. We need to create motivation for ourselves. We need to create motivation for one another. And we need to create motivation for ourselves. We've got yetzirahs, we've got all sorts of things that disturb us from doing that which is absolutely pure and absolutely right. We don't work that way. At the end of the day, we do what we want to do, except that Ribbono Shel Olam has given us the ability to enable us to present what is good in a way which makes it desirable. And that's the art of motivation, to make good things desirable to ourselves and to make bad things undesirable to ourselves. That's why these efforts to get people to stop smoking are often unsuccessful. But I want to smoke. I like it. I enjoy it. So you'll sit the fellow down and you'll prove to him that it's exceptionally harmful to his health, and the chances are, almost without question, that he's going to die many years before his time, maybe very soon in fact, because he's smoking. Ooh, he says, that, you're right. Can't argue. Takes out his cigarette and takes a puff. He said, but what are you doing? He says, I enjoy it. I like it. Unless you can make the cigarette unattractive for him. And of course, then one's battling against millions of dollars and rands and pounds and francs and marks of advertising. Because the purpose of the advertisement is just that. to take something harmful and make it desirable. That's what the advertisement is. And to battle against that force of advertisement is extremely difficult. But if they can do it, there's a tremendous limud. If the world can market smoking and still make you pay for the cigarettes, can you imagine how easy it is to market Torah, to market MS, to market fine things and beautiful things and attractive things? How easy it is, if only we'll market it. And we don't realize the importance of marketing, because we tend to think that marketing is dishonest. Marketing is dishonest if you're marketing a cigarette. Marketing is dishonest if you're marketing something with a flaw and you hide the flaw from the public to whom you're marketing. But marketing is not dishonest if it is used to promote something which is MS. Rivka used marketing to promote Yaakov to Yitzchak, and it worked. And that saved humanity. And so we use the tzura, we use the form, to market the chomer, to make the raw material desirable. Raw material in its own is not desirable. That's why it's so difficult to market do-it-yourself kits. Very hard. Because unless the person likes doing things himself, and therefore you're marketing to him not the finished product, you're marketing an exercise to him, you're marketing leisure to him, you're marketing a game to him, like a puzzle, a do-it-yourself kit. But if it's somebody like myself who hates doing things for himself, then it's very difficult. I know from experience, it doesn't work. All the marketing techniques don't work. The only thing is eventually price. It just might work out so much cheaper that you can't afford anything but doing it yourself. But it's very hard to make it desirable, because there's no tsuro. You're not marketing a finished product. So they cheat a little bit. They market, they show the pictures of the finished product. And it looks magnificent. It looks wonderful. They don't tell you all the pain and sorrows you go through before you get there. And when you finally get there, after hours and hours of trying to figure out the instructions and buying the tools and figuring out how to use them and cutting your fingers and breaking your hands a couple of times, finally you finish, and it doesn't look anything like the picture. That they don't tell you. They show you the picture. That's all they can market, to try and give it some kind of tsura. So they show you the picture at the end of it. But to market a finished product, even if it's much more expensive, is easy, because one can make it desirable. It is possible to make something desirable. Even if it's an undesirable thing, one can make it desirable. How much more so is it possible to make something desirable, truly desirable? And people will not commit themselves unless they need something or they desire something. They will not commit themselves to something which they intellectually acknowledge worthwhile, but they neither need it nor desire it. They will not commit themselves to that. You can convince a person that it's very good to learn Gemara, but unless you market it in a way that makes it desirable to learn Gemara, he will agree with you, it's very good to learn Gemara, but I don't need it, and I don't particularly want it at this stage in my life. And that's the end. There's nothing more you can do, unless one can make it desirable. And to make something desirable, one doesn't use facts. To make something desirable, one has to use emotion. One has to turn the person on. One must make him enthusiastic. One must make him excited. And they use color for that. You can't turn a person on with a black and white picture. I've forgotten, but some of you might know the ratio of effectiveness of a color advert to a black and white advert. Far more than the difference in price. As expensive as a color advert is, it's far more the ratio of effectiveness. You can't make somebody excited with a black and white photograph unless it's very, very artistically done, a very, very special kind of product that doesn't need the color. But if you want to make a person excited, you need color, and very often you need sound, music, sound, background, atmosphere. That's what makes a thing desirable. That's why in modern advertising, one can learn a lot from looking at adverts. In modern advertising, you hardly see the product. The product is not that important anymore in the advertising. That's subliminal. What's most important is the creation of an atmosphere. This feeling of elegance, or of wealth, or of status, whatever it is that they're trying to market. And when they've got you identifying with that and craving for it, your tongue is hanging out. You want to be just like that. You want a home just like that. You want a room just like that. Everything, you want a wife just like that. Everything must be just like that. And then they give you the secret how to achieve it. You just have to smoke downhill. And you've got it. All that is non-verbal communication. There is an example where verbal communication can't work. Because it isn't logical that you should smoke downhill or smoke anything else. It's totally illogical. One can't use verbal communication. Therefore, the whole thing has to be non-verbal communication. But this concept of chomer and tsura, using the tsura to make something desirable, presentation, the way you put something forward, one can say over a shir with nothing left out. One can say over the shir, but it's in a way that doesn't excite anybody at all. Doesn't sound attractive. One can say over the shir in a way that it is exciting and that it does sound attractive. The words can be the same. It's the body language, it's the movements, it's the excitement, it's the expression, it's the smile on the face, it's all the things that go with it. It can make one delivery exciting and alive, dynamic, and another delivery dull. Those deliveries lies not only in the fact that one has been exciting and one hasn't. The difference lies in the effect it ultimately has on the listener. An exciting delivery has appealed to an emotion and therefore strikes deep, and a dull delivery has appealed only to the intellect and therefore remains flat. And while you might have the factual knowledge, there isn't necessarily the effectiveness deep in the soul. But the Telzer Rov takes the concept of chomer and tsura a great deal further in a very exciting fashion. Telzer Rov says, human beings have bodies, as we know, and they have neshamas, they have souls, as we know too. But, he says, it's accepted in Kabbalah that human beings are not the only things that have bodies and that have souls. On the contrary, he says, there's nothing that doesn't have a body and a soul. Some form of soul, some form of nefesh, of neshama, everything has. What you see on the outside is only the chomer. That's only the raw material. Tsura is its soul. The formation, that is the soul of the thing. The raw material, you look at a stone, at a rock, it's the raw material. But what gives the rock that particular form? What keeps the molecules together in that particular orientation to create that impression? That's, so to say, the neshama of that rock. That inner power, that inner resourcefulness, that spirituality, that energy inside it, which gives it that particular form. That's why you can take the same molecules and mix them in different ways with different tsuras, and the same molecules take on different appearances. In fact, I suppose if one broke matter down to its most absolute basic components, one would find one component. Is that right? One and all, it would all look the same. It's only that they're combined in different ways. Take a hydrogen atom, I suppose. Everything else is really a development of different forms of a hydrogen atom. So many electrons, and such a nucleus, but it's all... At the end of the day, you're dealing with very identical little particles. What makes them unique? What makes each element unique? What makes each compound unique? If you're dealing with all the same things, just mixing them in different ways? That's as the Telzer Rov is the tsura. That's that neshama, that essential underlying component, mystical underlying component called the neshama or the nefesh or the tsura, formation of it. He says knowledge also has a tsura.
Knowledge also has a neshama. And he gives the example. He says, I can tell you that the sun is, and I forget how many times bigger. Does anybody know? How many times bigger the sun is than the earth? However many hundred thousand times bigger the sun is than the earth. He gives you that piece of factual information. But if you don't know how big the earth is, you have no clue, you have no idea how big the earth is. You're a bushman from the Kalahari and it's never entered your mind to consider how big the earth is. You don't, nothing at all. Then that statement has no meaning to you. Likewise, if you have no understanding of proportion, you don't understand proportion, you don't understand numbers, you can't fathom hundreds of thousands, it doesn't mean anything to you. You also will not know anything. You will not have any feeling for that knowledge. You will not be able to integrate that knowledge, although you know the facts. So you can go to the bushman in the Kalahari and you can say, how many times bigger is the earth than the sun than the earth? And he will tell you exactly. And you'll go to Professor Einstein and you'll say, how many times bigger than the earth is the sun? And he will tell you exactly. And you'll say, therefore, you see, even the bushman knows what Professor Einstein knows. Not a good equation. Because the quality of their knowledge is totally different. Whereas the Professor Einstein knows exactly, he can visualize the size of the earth. And he knows proportions. And he knows sizes. And he knows what the sun is. And he knows what the earth is. When you tell him that, he gets excited. It bowls him over. He gets goose flesh every time he thinks of that. Because it's such an incomprehensible thing to consider. He goes wild with enthusiasm when you tell him a little fact like that. The bushman just says, it doesn't affect him at all. What's the difference? They both have the knowledge. He tells the Rav, one has the chomer of the knowledge, one only has the body of the knowledge, the raw material, and the other has the tzura. He understands the deeper meaning of it. And so it is with all knowledge, says the Talmud. In fact, it says, knowledge that we acquire when we're children stays with us through our adulthood. Does it change? It depends on what kind of knowledge it is. If we only knew the chomer, if we only knew the raw material, then as we get older, the knowledge remains exactly the same. When we were small, we knew whatever it is, again, maybe how many times greater the earth, the sun is than the earth, and when we're adults, we know the same piece of information. And it means the same to us, then and now. But if it's the tzura, then as we mature, as we develop, as we grow, so our old knowledge becomes renewed and refreshed. We see new angles each time we think about it. Because we're relating to the neshama, we're relating to the soul of the knowledge, not the raw material of it. And the soul of the knowledge can only be understood by my soul. My brain can't understand the soul of the knowledge. Only my neshama can understand the soul of the knowledge. And as my neshama develops, and as it matures, and as it grows, so my neshama understands the knowledge better and better and better. And the chomer remains the same. The raw material is the same. The structure of the knowledge is the same. But the feeling for it, the integration of that knowledge, the depth of understanding of that knowledge, that changes and develops as we get older. It brings a beautiful illustration of that concept from a Gemara in Sanhedrin. So the Gemara says that one isn't allowed to start paskening dinner in a foshus on a Friday. The basin has to sit in a serious matter. Can't sit on a Friday. And the Gemara discusses why not. He says, because what are you going to do? Comes to the conclusion, the only thing you might be able to do, the only way you might be able to do it so is not to finish on Friday and leave the poor person waiting until Sunday before you give him his sentence. So you can't stop a case in the middle. So eventually the Gemara says, the only thing then to do is Nadaine b'mayli shabso. Let's sit on Friday. And we'll go through all the evidence, and we'll go through the debate and the discussion all on Friday. The nigmere b'chad b'shabse, and the gemar din, we'll give our sentence on Sunday so that we can execute him immediately after that. The only problem is we're not allowed to delay the execution after sentence has been given. But to delay the sentencing, that one can. So let us listen to the case on Friday, we'll sentence on Sunday, and then we can execute him immediately. That says the Gemara is no good, because min shuta mayu. The judges will forget their reasoning by the time Sunday comes. And you can't give a Gemara din, you can't decide if the facts aren't clear and fresh in your mind. After Gemara, Afa gav the shnei sefrei hadayonim pindim mitmeim v'chitzim divrei hanazakim v'divrei hanachayvim. How can you forget? There are two scribes there that stand and write every word of those who argue in favor and every word of those who argue against. The whole argument is written down. Answers the Gemara, Nehi de bepume kasrin, libi de inshi inshi. It's true. What was said verbally can be written down. What was said non-verbally can't. And here we have the clearest definition in halacha of non-verbal communication. Rashi. Even though you'll remember the principles of what was said, Mishkach milibui yishuvoi letamai. The integrated, settled understanding you will have lost. That's it. Sometimes one's learning Gemara and one's in the middle of a sugya and one sees very clearly exactly what's going on. You understand Rashi clearly and you understand Tosfos clearly. You think, right, call it a day, you'll go to bed. Next day you open your Gemara again and you can say it all over again. But there's something missing. That freshness which you had yesterday, where you knew exactly where everything was and you knew exactly what was happening and what you were going to investigate next and why you had to investigate it next. A bit of the sharpness is gone. One forgets that. And it doesn't help having taken notes the night before. Once you leave it and you're out of it for a little while, you can get back to the details, but you can't reconstruct that underlying integrated deep understanding of what's going on. That's the liber de inchi. The non-verbal communication can't be written down. You've got to start again. You've got to start the Gemara from scratch and go through it and rebuild it from the very beginning again. And for that reason, the Dayonim are not allowed to sit on Friday and continue on Sunday, because it will be impossible for them to reconstruct the whole non-verbal dynamic of the debates in the court case. That's why in Edus we say in Mipihem Veloy Mipi Ktovam. When we accept evidence, the witness has to be present. No affidavit. Because in an affidavit you can get the facts. The verbal communication comes through in an affidavit. But a judge needs access to the non-verbal communication. He wants to watch the person giving the evidence. He wants to see how credible the person is. He wants to get all the subliminal non-verbal messages as well. And form an impression, a general impression, which is going to determine how severely he's going to cross-examine that aid, how far he's going to pursue it, how much more evidence he's going to search for. All this helps him reconstruct what took place. Not just the written word. It has to be dynamic. And that's why we have a Torah Shebaal Peh. Because you can pass down facts in writing, but you can't pass down the neshoma of the Torah. You can't pass down the surah. You can't pass down that indefinable subliminal non-verbal communication which comes down from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That one can't pick up in the written word. That's for that one needs Messiah. And the Torah Rav brings the beautiful Gemara in Yerushalmi. Perek Hamishi of Beitzer, Halacha Beit. Rebbe have a mesev le Rabbi Shimon Bereh. Rebbe, the great Rabbi Yehuda Anosi, we've been learning about with the ladies in the Friday morning Rambam Shir, made a wedding for his son Rabbi Shimon. V'hovu metapchin la'achire yedeyen b'shufse. It was Shabbos. It was either Sheva Brochus, so that was the reception. They might have had the chuppah on Friday. And they were singing and clapping in a way which Rebbe held was mutter on Shabbos. You were allowed to clap that way on Shabbos. Ovar Rabbi Meir v'shoma kolim. Rabbi Meir walked past outside and heard them clapping. Omar, he said aloud so that they should hear inside. Is this what happened? Does Shabbos now become unimportant? Clapping on Shabbos? Shoma Rebbe Kali, Rebbe heard his voice. Omar, and he said, who is this who's coming to persecute us inside our houses? Amazing concept. Rabbi Meir, you know I'm here. What right have you got to pass comment about what's going on halachically in a place where there's a Rov, where there's a Moreh D'Asra? What right have you got to pass a comment, even though you were standing outside the window? Where do we find such a thing? Wherever has such a thing been allowed? That one Rov will pass a comment publicly to what another? If you disagree with me, you'll meet me in the Beis HaMedrash tomorrow and you'll ask me why. But that you pass comment in an area where I have authority? When they heard Rebbe's reaction, when the guests heard Rebbe's reaction, firstly when Rabbi Meir heard Shomer, Rabbi Meir Kali, Rabbi Meir heard that it was Rebbe inside there, the Orak, and he ran. The only time of any way I can appreciate that really, Rebbe running, Rabbi Meir running. Once when I was visiting Eretz Yisrael, my brother asked me whether I'd ever seen a brisker. I said, no. Have you never seen a descendant of the Chaim? Never seen a son of the Brisker Rov? I said, no. At that time, he wasn't on sufficiently intimate terms with the Mayor Soloveitchik to introduce me. Come, I'll show you a brisker. You've got to see one at least. You can't even live like that without seeing a brisker. He said, in about half an hour's time, the David Soloveitchik learns in his sitting room and from the street. If you just climb onto the wall a little bit, you can see him. Come, we'll go and you'll see a brisker. Sure, not a question, what an opportunity. So we waited the half hour eagerly and off we went. He climbs onto the ledge and looks. Strangely enough, no sign of the dog. And I, getting eager, so I climb onto the ledge and I look and look. No sign of the dog. All of a sudden, I realize that he's standing in the dark from the balcony, 2 feet away from us, staring at us, just as eagerly as we were staring, looking for him. I just looked, and only somebody who's seen a brisker knows what a stare from a brisker is. I just said, there he is! And the two of us ran down the road, you cannot believe how fast. But it was an experience. It was an experience to see that look, to see that stare. What were we running from? Were we scared that he would come chasing us? What were we running from? Frightening. It was the most amazing look. Not angry, no. He was curious. He was curious about us as we were about him, I suppose. Shoma Rabbi Meir Kali V'Orak. Rabbi Meir just heard Rebbe's voice and he ran. Imagine Rabbi Meir running. Natsi Imperi Basri Likri. And they ran, the guests ran after him. They wanted to bring him back to Rebbe to answer for his actions. And you can imagine, running is usually an undignified sort of thing. Very undignified. And one very seldom sees a dignified person, a godel Yisrael, one very seldom sees him running. It's the best to catch the next one. You don't run. Running is unless you're running to a mitzvah, you're running and walking fast, for sure. If you're running through the streets, if you're coat flying in the wind, if you're quickly dressed, your hat's blowing, it's just not dignified. They don't do it. You can imagine how odd it was to see Rabbi Meir running down the street. Afrach rucho bikaile me'al kadle de Rabbi Meir. The wind, he was running and the wind undid his scarf from around the neck of Rabbi Meir as he was running. Edik Rebbe min kavse. Rebbe wanted to hear what all the commotion was about, so he went over to the window and looked outside. The Chama Kadle de Rabbi Meir min Achrivot. All he saw disappearing into the distance was Rabbi Meir, and all he could see of Rabbi Meir was the back of his neck. It might well have been nighttime, and Rabbi Meir was going off and probably dressed in dark clothes, and all he could see was the back of his neck. Or it means that was the only part of him that was revealed. Clothes on, long clothes, hat, that's all he could see. Omar, Rebbe said, the great Rebbe, the author of the Mishnah, the greatest Talmid Chochem, the greatest Godel of his time, in a time not of ordinary people, but in a time of Tanoim, says, Rebbe, Loizochis, Anol, Oraiso, the only reason that I achieved excellence above my colleagues in Torah, Elo, was for one thing only, not the amount of Torah I learned, not the clarity with which I learned it. One thing I attribute my superiority to. Because I saw the back of Rabbi Meir's neck. And that's not his poetic image. That means that Rebbe believed that his life changed from that moment, his stature changed, his understanding of Torah changed, and at that moment he achieved superiority over all his colleagues. He saw the back of Rabbi Meir's neck. Who knows exactly what it means? But on the simplest of simple levels, he saw the dignity of Rabbi Meir even when he was running away. That's utter dignity. When Avrom Zizinski was being taken from Kovna, I think it was Kovna, to run away from the Nazis, and there was a chance of saving him, and so he was running away into the with some partisans or towards to some partisans in the forest, and he took his hat and his jacket. And I said to him, look here, this isn't the time to worry about your hat and jacket, this is time to put on your running shoes and get going. The answer, Lo'ilom al yeshane odom min harabon ishul. A person should never abdicate his dignity. He learned pshat in that doesn't mean you should never do it when you're standing in shul. Doesn't mean that you should never do it when you're addressing a meeting or when you're dancing at a chasana. Even when you're running for your life, you don't abdicate your dignity. Because Rebbe, I saw the back of Rabbi Meir's neck as he ran down the street. And that changed my life. That gave me stature, that gave me everything I've got. Because the Torah of all the knowledge was the chomer, the knowledge was the raw material, but this gave a new tzura to everything he knew, this gave a new form to all the knowledge he had. It infused a certain excitement and nobility and depth of understanding of what the Torah was, that the Torah could produce a man like Rabbi Meir, that the Torah could produce such dignity, that even when the man is running down the street, he has this enormous dignity. That is what Rebbe gained from Rabbi Meir. The Gemara goes on to say, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Tarveyu Namrin, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish both said they were brothers-in-law. Anan lo yizachinan lo araisa. We only made progress in Torah, elo begin the chaminan et baite the Rebbe min gukin today. Because we saw the finger of Rebbe sticking out of his sleeve. That's what gave us everything we've got. See the separate body language. While he was giving his shiur or whatever the circumstance was, they saw his hand, they saw his finger. That gave them everything that they said. We can't understand these things, it's way beyond us. But at least we do see that there's an area of communication which is at least as important, if not more important, than the verbal communication. And that's the area of communication that gives one the neshama of the Torah. That gives us that spirit, that soul of the Torah, the tzura of the Torah, which cannot be communicated by words alone. And so we find now that not only are we using tzura to market, not only are we using tzura to create desirability, we're using presentation now, not only to create desirability and to make a thing exciting and enthusiasm an individual, but the Telzer Rov says that it is not possible to communicate spirituality without nonverbal communication. Words cannot communicate the neshama of the Torah. It's only the dynamics of interpersonal contact. It's only when you see the Rosh Hashiva's face light up, when you see his eyes, when you see his hands, when you see his whole body move with excitement as he explains the pshat in the Tosfos. Then you get an idea of the neshama of what's deep inside it. And your neshama is moved by it. Because words can communicate to ears. Maybe words can communicate even to a brain, but words cannot communicate to a soul. Only a soul can communicate to a soul. And the soul's method of communication is not verbal. Well, I'm going to change the term slightly and say not only verbal, And instead of talking about nonverbal communication, we should start talking about extraverbal communication, because the two are inextricably bound together. One needs both. And whereas one can use words to communicate ideas, to communicate concepts, facts, knowledge, information, words alone cannot communicate to a neshama. A neshama can only be communicated to when there's excitement, when there's dynamicism, when there's movement, when there's enthusiasm, when there's warmth. That's when a neshama gets communication. That's when two neshamas communicate one with another. One finds, I've often been asked about people who have problems with emunah, belief. The problems with belief are usually not intellectual, because when I sit down with a person, I say, what's your problem? Do you really not believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam? Fascinating. I'm absolutely fascinated. I'm talking about the Torah, not atheist. Sometimes I have a difficulty with belief. That happens a lot, many, many times, and many people have the problem. And they say, no, not always, but at times I sit down and I wonder, is it really true? Is it really all on? And I said, but just go through it, just start. The world and the... He says, I know, you can tell me intellectually, of course there must be a Ribbono Shel Olam. But it doesn't convince me. What does that mean, that a person can be told something and say, intellectually, of course you're right, but it doesn't convince me? That means my neshama isn't convinced. My ears are convinced, and my brain is convinced, and you can give me as much fact as you want, and you won't convince me more. My neshama needs convincing. And sometimes I say to people, you know, to learn some Torah, get busy learning, get going, the emunah comes. And they get learning and the emunah doesn't come. And when I was preparing this shiur, I was trying to analyze that very point, why does the emunah not come to some people when they get learning? And I found in most of the cases in my own experience, that's all I can talk about, those people who after learning are still not moved in emunah, are learning with their heads and with their minds and with their mouths, but they're not involved in the dynamics, the excitement. One doesn't hear them screaming at their chavrus. One doesn't hear them jumping with joy as they've understood a Torah. That they're not getting. Sometimes they're not getting it because they're not learning in a shiur. They're reading, they're learning on their own. And so there isn't that tension. There isn't that dynamics, there isn't that excitement. Sometimes they get it because that's their personality. They're very difficult people to excite and to motivate. Sometimes it's because they're just not holding yet in learning at a point where they can get excited by it. Different levels. Our Rosh Hashiva's shiur used to be very exciting, but only if you understood what was going on. It was by no means dry. It was very dramatic. And he used to shout and scream and jump. But if you didn't know what was going on, you saw him shouting and screaming and jumping, but it didn't move you. And he was aware of that. And he was aware that very few people really did understand what was going on. He was very clever. He used to bring up from Yerushalayim once a week a Maggid Shir, an outstanding Maggid Shir. His method he didn't like, because the method was drama. The Shir, there was nothing terribly much to the Shir. It was usually a printed Shir of somebody else, or very often a printed shiur of somebody else, or sometimes it was his own. The shiur was nice, but nowhere near the stature and the quality of his shiur. But there was such drama. It was the week's entertainment. Everybody used to crowd into that shiur to listen to that shiur. Because that shiur, whether you understood it or not, it was a pleasure to listen to. It was such a pleasure to listen to. There was a joke thrown in here and there. There was histrionics, and there was drama, and there was every technique that you could imagine of entertainment was there, and one could enjoy it. And he felt that was important, and I never understood why. And I used to say to him, if you hold that yours is the right way, why do you cater for people who can't understand you? And if you're catering for them, why do you give such a difficult shiur? I understand that it was important for emunah. People needed to be involved, emotionally involved in their learning. And he realized that he couldn't give that to people who weren't on the level to follow his shiur. I just want to read to you a very brief part from the Tel Zerov. Before we do that, just by the way, since it is after all Mitzvah Shabbos B'Shalach, B'Shlach Lecha, if you go through the parasha of the Meragli, what happened there was also a non-verbal communication story. the Meraglim get into Eretz Yisrael, the spies get into Eretz Yisrael, and they bring back facts. The facts they bring back are all accurate. The places, there are giants all over the place. Massive fortified cities. Dr. Bjorkman spoke on Tuesday night of the intimidation that is used at times, whether in courtrooms or in times of negotiation, big desks, raised seats, lowered seats, hard chairs, to make the person who needs to be manipulated feel as uncomfortable as he can. He comes into the room and you say, my goodness, look at this, such a big desk, paneled office, massive chair behind the desk, bank of telephones, secretaries and secretaries outside. Phew, must be a great man. A person who really understands nonverbal communication is exactly the opposite. Never, poor fellow. He needs such a big desk. So many telephones he needs to impress me. He's got to impress me. He's got anything else to impress me with. All those telephones. And so many secretaries. How many secretaries can one person handle? All to impress me. And he has to pay them. Just to impress me, poor fellow. Got anything else to impress me with. That's the way that one should understand it. That's the misuse of nonverbal communication. They came back, such fortified cities. Moshe said, I want you to know whether the cities are fortified or not. Meaning, the nonverbal communication message was, because if they're fortified, it's a walkover for us. That means they're scared. That means they're insecure and defensive. They misunderstood the message. They came back anxious and scared. They were conned by the act. They came back conned by the act. They were unable to see through it. And they caused all the panic in Am Yisrael because of that. That's what one can understand. Lots of parishes with easy service. Finally, let's just read this last part from the Shir of the Tells of Rov. Yesh lo das ki ahevdel ben ish tzuro l'she'eno ish tzuro. He now calls different people an ish tzuro, and a person is not an ish tzuro. One who has the capacity to see beneath a chazal, to understand the depth of a Gemara, to understand the soul of a Gemara, and become excited by it. Not to become excited by the fact that I finished another daf. That's not what we're talking about. Not to become excited by the fact that I've finished another mesechta. That's not tzuro, that's chomer. And very superficial chomer at that. And one of the tests is, what are you excited about? If a person comes and says, I must say over to you this Tosfos. Let's learn this Tosfos together. I can't sleep at night. Just look at this. It's magnificent. Then you're talking to an Ishtur. A person comes to you and says, how many blood did you learn this week? Only a quarter of the blood this week. We finished the Masechta in 2 weeks. You're not dealing with an Ishtur. There's no Tzuro there. And he calls them, these are different human beings. One is an Ishtur and one is not. And an Ish Tzuro, says the Tzuro of Nikaru Bechol Yediyosov Rikshayosov. Not just here and there that you'd notice him. He is clearly identifiable in all his knowledge and in all his emotions. Gam Emunosu Yacheres Lagamri. His Emuno, his belief is different. Yosei Ramuko, it's deeper. Yosei Behiro, it's clearer. Yosei Pnim, it's more internal. Me'asher Etzul Zeh Shechoser Lo HaKriach La'asir Tzurat Kodovo. From the person who only sees the surface, who can only see the chomer, and doesn't have the capacity to see the exciting underlying depth of that which he's studying. By the second person, his belief is not internalized, and it is not integrated with his soul. You say, do you believe in God? He says, of course I believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. He can utter the formulas, he knows the phrases. Do we really have that deep emuna? Because the Tzuro of can't be. That's the chomer that we need to, that's the Tzuro that we need to pursue. To understand that yes, there is verbal communication and there is nonverbal communication. And verbal communication was given to us in order to express our deepest thoughts and feelings. But since we are not God, and therefore our speech, our power of speech, can function separately to our deeper thoughts and consciousnesses, it is possible for us to use our thoughts to mislead, as Asaph did. that even that ability can be used well, not to mislead chas v'sholem, but at least to excite and infuse, to present something not as dry facts, but to take the dry facts and present them with excitement and with persuasion and with enthusiasm in a way which makes them desirable. And not only then does one succeed in making something which otherwise might have been dry and undesirable, not only does one succeed in making that desirable, but we have to tell the Rav Yisrael that in everything that is in the Shomer, including in knowledge, there is the surface of the knowledge, the chomer of the knowledge, the factual information, and there is the intellectual understanding, the deep intellectual understanding. A fact can't excite a person. Knowledge, intellectual understanding, bino, can understand the person, can excite a person. Chokhmah can't excite a person. Bino, deep understanding, can excite a person. But for that bino, one has to learn not only with one's mind, one has to learn with one's soul as well. And when one has grasped the neshoma of the Torah, if one wishes to communicate that neshoma, it cannot be communicated verbally. For that kind of communication, one needs one's whole being, one needs one's whole essence. That's one of the reasons that we learn Torah in a chavrusa. So that there can be talking out, that there can be dynamics, that there can be argument, that there can be movement, that there can be body language. That's why we have to learn Torah aloud, even when you're on your own. You've got to learn it aloud. And you've got to, as if you're learning with somebody else. I had the famous story of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, with a guest who was waiting outside for him. Waits and waits, and hears Reb Chaim learning and doesn't want to interfere. Waits and waits and waits. And after a long time, he opens the door gently and he puts his face in the house and says, "Oh, I've been waiting for you." He says, "Sorry, I didn't want to disturb you." And the Rabbi, "Who is the kind? Where is the child you were teaching?" And the Chaim answered, "Richten the kind." "I'm a child, I was learning, that's how I learned." So the Chaim Soloveitchik, because he was teaching a child, with all the body language and all the extraverbal communication that goes into teaching a child, all that goes in, that's how we learn, because that's where the neshama of the Torah lies. That's why we learn in a shir. Why we sit together in a shir where there's dynamics, where there's presentation, where there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end, there's a build-up, to create that excitement so that one can start relating to the nishmas ha-Torah, to the tzura of the Torah, and feel some enthusiasm about it. Not merely acquire a logical, factual argument which contains nothing enthusiastic about it at all. That's why that's the tradition of the way we learn and the way we teach. Then we find that we're using our nonverbal communication not only to introduce marketing and attractiveness, but actually to communicate that essence of Torah, the neshama of Torah, that soul of Torah, which cannot be communicated verbally, but which needs all the skills and all the brilliance that we can master in the forms of extraverbal communication.